Okay, very good. All right. So, this is the beginning of part three of our class on anti-Semitism. Tonight, we are going to try to cover four different topics: the French Revolution, Napoleon Bonaparte, or as we say in French, Napoleon Bonaparte. Same. The Pale of Settlement, and also we'll talk about the pogroms. And that will lead us for next week into the Dreyfus Affair, 1896 in France, and Theodore Herzl reporting on the Dreyfus Affair and his reaction to it, and how he was instrumental in the birth of the modern Zionist movement. So next week we'll be talking about the Zionist, the birth of Zionism. We need to understand the importance of Zionism, as today Zionism is equated to racism. So before we can agree, and of course none of us do, but before we agree or we disagree with something, we need to know what is meant by the word. So next week we'll take a good look at what it means, what the word Zionism mean, and how it came about and where it is today. But before we get there, the close of last lesson, we talked about, we finished with the, you know, the we talked about the Age of Wandering, Poland, the Chmelnicki massacres, and the false messiah, Shabbatai Tzvi, and the birth of Hasidic Judaism. And so we're about the close of the 18th century, and we're just about turning the corner. It's just about the time for the French Revolution. At the close of the 18th century, the Jews found themselves at the dawn of a new era. There's really, things are going to change for the Jewish people. It's going to be a little better for a while, but again, they haven't seen the worst yet. That's coming around the corner with the pogroms and the Holocaust. But for right now, a few things are going to happen. They're going to make the Jewish life a little more, a little easier for Jews of Eastern Europe, of Europe in general, sorry. The feudal system had crumbled to make room for a developing capitalist and industrial revolution. Financial knowledge and shrewdness was becoming more of an asset, especially for leaders of countries in development. As a result, Jewish people, who had been forced, remember when we go back into the Middle Ages, and Jewish people were forced into financial world because they couldn't own any property. They ended up being bankers, and they would loan money and interest. So I don't want to go back into that, but they were forced into that, and they developed this business savviness they became expert in finances. So their involvement in Jewish people were somewhat less stigmatized for their involvement in the financial world, and they even became more appreciated by some, not everybody, of course, but there was an appreciation of the Jewish knowledge in the financial world, and people were getting advice from Jewish people, from Jewish bankers. This is about that time when the Rothschild family, they were German Jews in origin, when they started to make a name for themselves and starting developing a real banking system. The Rothschild family goes back to the 1700s, but it's about the time in the late 1700s where they started to become famous for their involvement in the world of finance. Question? Okay. Along with the advent of the Age of Emancipation, which is that time right now in history, as a byproduct of the French Revolution of 1789, the concept of citizenship was becoming more of a reality all throughout Europe. Inhabitants of a given country were starting to receive citizenship in that very country. And that actually would be taken to the next level by Napoleon. We'll look at him in a little bit. Along that time of the Age of Emancipation, when you hear emancipation, there's several words that are kind of like intertwine or overlapping, or intertwine is a better word. Emancipation, assimilation and enlightenment. All those things happen kind of like in a, they're not the same, but they're related. This is the age of emancipation. For the Jewish people, there is a special emancipation of the Jewish people. It's known as the Haskalah, the age of enlightenment. And it reached all segments of Jewish people at that time in Europe, all across Judaism theologically, from very conservative, very orthodox, to not so orthodox. Mind you, back in those days, we start to see some division within Judaism as far as orthodox, not so orthodox, quote-unquote conservative, or not so conservative, quote-unquote reform, and everything that we have today, not quite to the point where we have it today. We're starting to see some division within Judaism, but up to a little bit before that, we really only have one kind of Jewish person. It was, you were a Jew, you kept the Torah, you kept kosher, you were basically an Orthodox Jew. So this age of enlightenment reaches all segments of Judaism, all across theologically and all across geographically. It really did not, it went all across. The only place when it didn't go as deep and as and it was not so intense was in Eastern Europe, for reasons that we'll see in a minute. This age of emancipation, or Haskalah for the Jewish people, can also be understood as or known as the age of assimilation. Many Jews benefiting from the emancipation also looked into the claims of Christianity. We have people like, I didn't list them here, but I think it's at around that time that a British Prime Minister, Benjamin Disraeli, became a Christian, Jewish or Messianic Jew, a Hebrew Christian, or whatever you want to call him. Just don't call him late for dinner. But Benjamin Disraeli became a one of the famous first early Messianic Jews. So there was interest because Jewish people were allowed to intermingle and with the rest of the world a lot more than they had been able to up to that point. The split between the more traditional religious communities and the more liberal emancipated ones was widening. A lot of Jewish people did not want to continue study Torah and be Orthodox, kosher-keeping Jews. They wanted to remain Jewish in identity, but they were not really interested in all the Jewish trappings. So at that time, those who were not, these Jewish people saw an opportunity. They were like, oh, wait a minute, we are Jews. We can still remain Jewish, but we don't have to do all the, keep the Sabbath and keep kosher and go to synagogue and wear all the garb and everything. So you see a little bit of a widening of a split, not really a split, but choices are being made. You can be Jewish and be a practicing Jew, or you can be Jewish and not really be practicing, which is really an innovation. Question?
So that would be like diversifying.
Right, diversifying. Yes, and they're also as a result, to assimilate into the world. That's the time when you have what's known as salon Jews, when you have intellectual and Jewish people interacting with intellectuals and thing like that. It's not going to last for very long, and it's not going to happen. It's not going to be 100% for all the Jewish people, and it's only for a time. But it really, it's a big deal because this is where. This is where the spectrum of Judaism started to really broaden. I mean, before that, you're Jewish, you keep the law, end of story. Okay, you're an Orthodox Jew was all there was. Basically, they were the descendants of the Pharisees or the rabbinic Jews of the first century, and there's never been anything different up to that point. All of a sudden, now we start to see some diversity. A good example of this openness to Christianity was Moses Mendelssohn. That's a very Jewish name when you think about it. Moses Mendelssohn. Mid-1700, he was born. He was born in 1728, died 1786. Even though he was destined for a rabbinic career, learned mathematics, Latin, and other languages while also teaching himself many other disciplines. Mendelssohn was responsible for a certain amount of rapprochement, as we say in French, between German Christians and Jews, working together and getting along better. He's often described as the father of Reform Judaism. Okay. Now, again, this is where we start seeing, you know, change, you know, different kind of Jewish people. Now, he's the father. Let's assume, and I agree with that. He probably can be seen as the father of Reform Judaism. Reform Judaism today, you have women rabbi, you have homosexual rabbis. It's very liberal. Basically, Reform Judaism means liberal Judaism. You have Reform Judaism that came out of this enlightenment and assimilation emancipation, all that together. And then you have the rest of the Jewish people. We still want to practice Judaism, Orthodox. So there is one very, very Orthodox group of Jewish people, you know, by the law, by the book, by the 613 commandments. Then you have Reform Judaism. Just about anything goes. Then you got to find some kind of a, you know, middle ground where I want a little bit of the modern aspect of the 20th or the 19th century and following centuries. But I want a little bit of the tradition. So out of that, in America, was born the conservative movement, where they are not really Orthodox. They're not really Reform. They're kind of conservative. So, and a lot of people, a lot of Jewish people, like to call themselves conservative Jews because it kind of fits. It's kind of like people saying, like, I'm a Christian. They don't even know what they're talking about. Okay? Right. Yeah. I mean, we don't want to, you know, it's not 100% the same, but in a sense, it's like it's the middle ground. And, you know, and they all have their opinion on who's a Jew, of course, but conservative was born in out of, you know, too much departure, too much in the roots of old Judaism. Something's got to give. We've got to meet somewhere. That's conservative Judaism. And, of course, now you've got a lot, many more than just those three, but, and that's not even in the notes. So that was all free. That was not in the notes. All right. So yeah, and then in your notes here, you got a picture of Moses Mendelssohn. Okay. Now, the French Revolution. Ah, the French Revolution. 1789. That's the date that, of course, us French kids, when I was in school, I had to learn all those dates. You know, 1789 was the French Revolution. It brought on a dramatic change to France something that was put together known as the Déclaration Universelle des Droits de l'Homme, or Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That's only about a little less than 20 years after the U.S. The U.S. was with the Bill of Rights and then the Declaration of Independence. You know, you're looking at less than 20 years. But that was quite interesting. It did not exclude the Jews while not including them specifically either, even though they had lobbied for their emancipation and pleaded with many nobles, including King Louis the 16th himself. Eventually, the declaration, after 2 years of work, was ratified in 1791, giving Jewish people more freedom and validating their further emancipation. The French Revolution was instrumental in the birth of the concept of freedom of religion, provided it did not interfere with public order. This happened at a time where most European countries were restricting the rights of religious minority groups like the Jewish people. The assimilation of Jews was starting to happen. Now, the last two pages of your outline, I put it for you there, and I'm not going to read it, but I put the, it should be there, the Universal Déclaration Universelle des Droits de l'Homme, or Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Napoleon's going to pick up on that and go further, but if you look in the middle, after the preamble, in the middle of the page, men are born and remain free of and equal in rights. Social distinctions can be based only upon benefit for the community. This is unheard of up to that point. This was like a big deal. There's what, 17 articles, and one build upon the next one. It's very similar to what we have in America. You can read it. It's very, if you read it and you try to apply that to the Jewish people, it's going to change a lot of things. Jewish people are going to have something to go to now. That is a legal document that, even though people might continue to display acts of anti-Semitism, and now we have something that is a lot more in favor of all people in general, not specifically for the Jewish people, but not excluding them either. Something that is going to end up replacing, remember those antiquated codes that we talked about, the Justinian Code and the Theodician Code in the early church fathers and in the Middle Ages? Well, that stuff is going to be replaced by all this. That's going to give many rights to the Jewish people. So top of page 3, soon would come a leader like no others, with military might seldom if ever equaled. Napoleon Bonaparte was just around the corner, and he would push Jewish assimilation even further. Next now is, I want to talk about Napoleon Bonaparte. We'll just call him Napoleon. Yes. Yes.
And you said that was out from under Orthodoxy. So that was their religious emancipation. So then here you're talking about emancipation in the realm of the government.
It all happened at once. Okay. It all happened at once. It was... No. It's at the beginning. Remember, I told you about enlightenment and enlightenment, emancipation, and assimilation. All kind of happen. It's all part of the package of the Haskalah Jewish movement, where they were more accepted. Finally, their financial shrewdness was paying off. They were like, you know what? We can use your knowledge about the financial world, and now we have the human rights. The Declaration of the Human Rights. So, all of us and all this put together, it's given them freedom like they've never experienced before. But don't hold your breath; it's not going to last long. Yes. That's very good point that Ruben is making. The further we get away from our roots and our customs and our practices, the more we'll be accepted. And that is something that is going to be believed, especially in France, up to 1896. And with the Dreyfus Affair, Theodore Herzl is going to come and do a report. He's going to follow the whole thing for the news from Austria, and he's going to realize emancipation did work, but not for the Jews. We'll look at the Dreyfus Affair next week, and that's going to be the catalyst for the birth of the modern Zionist movement and everything that comes after that. So, but, we're getting ahead of ourselves. That's Ruben's fault. Thanks, Ruben. That was a good...
This is where
thank you. Did that help a little bit? What he was... It was... Okay. So, Napoleon. Okay. Napoleon... when I first put my title, I said, Napoleon, friend or foe, ? And then I thought, no, Napoleon, friend and foe, ? There's no question about it. That he was both a friend and a foe, an enemy of the Jewish people. Whatever he did and didn't do with the Jewish people, it benefited the Jewish people. Okay, that's at the end of the day, I want you to know, as crazy as Napoleon was, and he was somewhat of a dictator, and he had he made a lot of mistakes, and he was delusion of grandeur, but he did, in his actions, he helped the advancement of the Jewish people of Europe. So how did he do that? Well, let's take a look at that. Napoleon, so 1769, so he was born 20 years before the French Revolution. He was 20 during the Revolution. Was born in the French island of Corsica. I recommend, if you can ever go there, it's absolutely gorgeous. I love Corsica. Have you been there? It's gorgeous. It's a small island that in his days, one day it would belong to France, and then the next week it would belong to Italy, and they would fight over the island back and forth and back and forth. Some people said that Napoleon was Italian. We kind of claim him, but it doesn't really matter. So he was born in 1769 and he died in 1829, so died at the age of 52. Was born in Corsica. He went to the French military school at age 12 and then to the prestigious École Militaire de Paris, which is a French military school in Paris. Very quickly made a name for himself in the French army. He served during the French Revolution, though most of it was in Corsica on the island until he and his family returned to the mainland. In 1804, he became France's emperor by crowning himself Napoleon Ier, Napoleon I. The painting, famous painting that you can see at the Louvre, right under in the middle of the page here, you see Napoleon crowning himself, after taking the crown from the Pope's hand, who usually is supposed to crown him. He crowned himself. Now, apparently, the story goes that he did it, but the real story is that the Pope had pre-agreed to let him do it. So, you know, it's not like really a last-minute thing. But he did want to crown himself, separation of church and state. He wanted to crown himself, and then he crowned, Josephine, his lady. And sitting in the very back in the center, on a beautiful chair in the back in the center, is his mother. And he was very close to his mother. It's a painting that is huge. It's probably the size of this whole wall right here, and if you ever go to the Louvre, you got to see it. It's absolutely gorgeous. So that's my artistic inclination. I can't talk about something like this without mentioning that it's beautiful. He became Emperor of France. Same year, he introduced Le Code Napoléon, the Napoleon Code, which was the first modern legal code to be adopted across Europe. They had similar, smaller codes in England and in France, but he introduced the code. It was a penal code. It was like this thing that a lot of it is still being used today. Has been, you know, improved upon, but it was a major step, legal code that was used across Europe. It was a major step in replacing the antiquated laws and codes of the now defunct feudal system of the Middle Ages. From the beginning, Napoleon had one goal in mind, not just for the French, by the way. He had one goal in mind: make the Jews of French into Frenchmen and French women. Of course, we want to be politically correct here, you know. The Jews of France into French citizens. That's what I should have written. He had no intention of stopping them from practicing Judaism in the privacy of their homes, but he just expected them to give their allegiance to the empire as all French citizens should. Now, Napoleon invaded a lot of countries and made them part of the empire. And in every country, he would do the same thing. He would say, be a citizen of that country, and at home, be a Jew. And the last country that he was not able to invade was Russia. And when you go to Russia today, it's the only country that when you talk to a Jewish person, you ask him, what are you? They say, I'm a Jew. If you go to France, you ask my parents, they say, I'm a French Jew. If you go to England, they'll say, I'm an Italian Jew. If you go to England, I'm a British Jew. Spain, I'm a Spanish Jew. If you go to Russia, you have the Russians and you have the Jews. Napoleon did not leave his mark there. Sorry? Sorry? Here? Yeah, that's, okay, you know, California nuts. Okay, so I thought, you know, it's interesting that, you know, the difference here. But, so he said, it was big, he said, be a French citizen in France, but in the privacy of your own home. Be a Jew as much as you want. Keep your heritage, keep your practices, your customs. And he expected them to give their allegiance to the empire, as all French citizens should. On the rest of the page, above and under the painting of Napoleon and the menorah here, is the same, almost the same paragraph. This is a typo, okay? The second, I just ran over my notes again today. I'm going like, oh, nice, Olivier. Four extra lines for free. So we're just going to read the bottom one because it has the extra. The painting is interesting. It's a painting of Napoleon granting freedom to the Jews in 1806. You see a menorah, and you see this Jewish person holding the Ten Commandments in their hand, and you see a rabbi on the left. And there's a story in some of the biographies of Napoleon. In one of his biographies, there's a story that when he came to Italy, and during one of the battles he had in Italy, he saw some Jewish people with a Star of David banner or around their sleeves, and they were serving in the Italian army. And he asked one of his soldiers, he says, "What are those things on their arms?" And he was told, "This is to recognize that they're Jews." And he immediately asked all of them to rip that stuff and said, "You know, you're Italians. Whatever you want to be in your home, you can be, but you don't have to wear those things." And he also closed the ghettos. He was instrumental in closing the ghettos in Italy and other countries. So he did some good. 1806, 2 years after he became emperor, he called for an assembly of notables. At the same time, Jewish notables, along with a meeting of the Sanhedrin. Believe it or not, I don't know how he gathered the Sanhedrin, but there was a reconvening of the Sanhedrin in 15 plus 100 years after the last one, which was in like the 300, something like that. I don't have the exact date. 358, it's in the note on the bottom of the of your notes here. The last binding decision of the Sanhedrin was in 358 when the Hebrew calendar was adopted. The Sanhedrin was dissolved after continued persecution by the Roman Empire. Over the centuries, there has been attempts to revive the institution, such as the Grand Sanhedrin convened by Napoleon Bonaparte. I think it was more of a gathering of Jewish rabbis and notables, and they called it the Sanhedrin. It didn't last very long, but it was an interesting attempt. Within that Jewish community, he gathered all these people and asked him questions about marriage, interfaith marriage, faith in general, patriotism, amongst others. And Napoleon was very satisfied with the response from the Jewish leaders, that they said they would die defending France. You have to understand something. What started with Napoleon is going to continue in the Jewish mindset all the way to the Second World War. My grandfather was a Jewish man. My whole family was Jewish. That was my father's father. He had fought in the Great War of 1914. And when he was asked, like all Jews of Paris first were supposed to take their radio, but they didn't want him to listen to the news, allies, you know, messages. So he said, all your radios have to be taken to the police station and confiscated. So he told his family, they said, "Don't do it." And he said, "We don't risk anything. We're okay. I fought in the Great War. I'm a veteran of the War of 1914-1918. I'm a French citizen. Nothing can happen to me. They respect me for who I am." So this concept of becoming part of the country was really, it was a deal. It started with Napoleon and it continued until the end of the Second World War. Jewish people did not believe at the beginning. Then when they realized what they needed to believe, it was too late. But at the beginning, they would go and abide by the laws of either the Nazis or the French Vichy government, thinking, "Hey, you know, we're French citizens. Nothing's going to happen to us." So, and that comes from what was established by Napoleon, which is not bad in itself. It's how it was used against the Jewish people that it was bad. But in and of itself, it's not bad. It's a good thing. So some have claimed that Napoleon's goal was simply to get rid of the Jews by process of assimilation, intermarriage, and conversion, as opposed to before and after elimination. He was quoted saying, and this is from a book, I give you the quote on the bottom notes here. He was quoted saying, "I will never accept any proposal that will obligate the Jewish people to leave France, because to me, the Jews are the same as any other citizen in our country. It takes weakness to chase them out of the country, but it takes strength to assimilate them." So you see two sides of Napoleon. He's kind enough to recognize that, you know, we have to, you know, the Jews are not a bad race, so we can't really do damage to them and force them to leave. At the same time, you know, I'm Napoleon. We have to be strong enough to make them into French people and assimilate them. So there's two sides to his personality here.
Influenced him for him to think this way? It certainly wasn't normal.
Well, no, I mean, he was not influenced by, well, Napoleon was not influenced by Germany. It's, no, well, I mean, Napoleon was in, you know, in early 1800, no, back then it would have been Prussia, not Germany, but it was, he was not influenced by Germany in any good or bad way. I don't know. I haven't read enough about him to know if he had an influence or he had a, you know, he's the one who came up, you know, this is the time where the Declaration of Universal Declaration of Human Rights was penned together, was put together, you know, at the end of the revolution, you know, 1791. He was emperor in 1804. You're looking at 13 years apart or 10 years apart. He was influenced by that. And other people in his entourage, I don't know exactly who, I have not read any solid Napoleon, maybe, but you know, I can't tell you. But I don't know who influenced him, but I know that some good came out of it. Paul?
Was he a
non-religious person? I don't think he was really into a, he was really trying to push a separation. I mean, obviously he took the crown from the Pope's hands, you know, like, let me handle this, you know, I'm the emperor, yeah. I think you might be right. You really looked at the emancipation, and then he says, "Hey, you know, let them do what they want to do. They're not harming anybody, as long as they support France and the government, and you know, and they enlist in the army and they help, and they're good citizens. You know, let them assimilate into the population and leave them alone." So I don't think it was. I don't think he was a Christian. Right. Yes. Staying away from Catholicism saved the Jews. Yeah. Well, saved the Jews. I don't know. Yes, Reuben. That's possible, but that's not an aspect of Napoleon I'm going to discuss right now. So, but that's possible. But we'll leave it in left field for now. We'll pick it up maybe later. So he was so sorry. Oh, is the red the marble? Yeah, it's huge. It's huge. That's right. It's huge. It's interesting. I do have, okay. I have to tell you. It will be on the recording, but I have to tell you because it's really a funny story, and I don't think I've told you before. I took my son JD to this huge museum in Paris years ago. He's now 23. I took him when he was about 10 or 11, the two of us, and it's the museum of weaponry. So you've got weapons from antiquity up to today. Every weapons, armors of all the eras of Europe and Africa. And, I mean, a 10-year-old kid is like, you know, it's just heaven. And then, of course, it's the museum called Les Invalides, the Invalids, which is where Napoleon's tomb is. There is like a mausoleum just for him. It's like a park just for him. It's a building just for his tomb. But aside from that, there is a whole series of rooms. You go from one room to the next to look at Napoleon's stuff. You know, his tent when he was, you know, doing the campaign of this, and his first hat, and his book, and his memoir, and his journal, and whatever, and this, all kinds of stuff. So I'm taking JD through those rooms, and then, you know, I explained to him who Napoleon was, and he said, oh, this is cool, you know, paintings of him and everything, and we go from one room to the next, and he looks at me at one point, and he goes, Dad, it's all this stuff about Napoleon. I mean, what's next? Are we gonna go to the next room, and it's gonna be Napoleon's dog? And we go to the next room, and there's a plexiglass case with a little white Fido dog looking like this, and it says on a plaque, Napoleon's dog. We could not believe it. So that's my Napoleon story. So to this day.
How tall was Napoleon?
Sorry?
How tall was he?
He was not very tall. I don't think. I don't know.
Have you seen the original film? There's a film, an actual footage of it. I went to see it when it came to LA.
The movie? Oh, I didn't know.
No, he died.
he died before a film existed. It's he died in 1850. He died in 1821. It possibly cannot be. He cannot possibly be a film. No, you're talking about an old movie by Abel Gance. Like an old 1900 movie, a silent movie, and it's an Abel, A-B-E-L, and then G-A-N-C-E.
It's
okay, yeah, it's an old movie. I don't even know how I remember that, by Abel Gance, and like, I don't even know where he's from. It's an old movie about Napoleon. It's a silent movie. Yeah. It's from the early 1900, but not the early 1800. Okay, I will find out how tall he is, but we got to finish the class. And his size has nothing to do with the Jews.
He was 5'6".
How do you know?
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, I feel sorry for those listening to the class on the internet, you know. Okay. Back to Napoleon. He was so, at the beginning of his interaction with the different countries and with the Jews, a few years after becoming emperor, he was so involved that the Russian Orthodox Church formally called him the Antichrist and the enemy of God, because they loved the Jews so much. And when they saw that he was helping the Jews, he said, he is the enemy of God. So Napoleon saw great benefits in protecting the Jews and was instrumental in doing so beyond France's borders. He also helped the Jews of Italy and other conquered countries and helped tear down the doors of many ghettos. As a result, he was originally admired by Jews across the empire. Judaism became the third official religion of France. Now, don't be mistaken thinking that it was Catholicism or Christianity and Islam. Okay, it was Catholicism and Protestantism and then Judaism. That's what we're talking about here at that time. Where was I? Okay. The Jewish community, in admiration, I was shocked when I found that out when I was doing my research. I did not know that. This is a new one for me. The Jewish community, in admiration for their Savior, even introduced a new prayer for Napoleon in the synagogue prayer books. Back in those days, they would say every Shabbat, they would recite a prayer. You Google it, you'll see the documents. They will recite a prayer for our Savior, Napoleon. Well, whatever, yeah, from the Catholic side, yeah. So, but it's not in the prayer books anymore. But back in those days, every week they would recognize that Napoleon played a part in the emancipation and the furtherance of the Jewish community of Europe in some great ways. But in 1808. Would only last so long. In 1808, caving under the pressure of many very upset leaders and statesmen, including French and different countries like Chateaubriand or Cardinal Fesch, Marshal Kellerman, and especially Russian Tsar Alexander, Napoleon felt obligated to introduce a restrictive decree. The Jewish community was in shock and lost much of its wealth and influence, almost to the point of a total bankruptcy. Overnight, because of this restrictive decree, the blossoming Jewish community that had some newfound freedoms in Europe, all of a sudden he said, okay, done. It was kind of like an impulsive decision, because he was getting a lot of pressure from a lot of other world leaders, and there was some political, beyond what we can understand today, I'm sure, there was a lot of political reasons behind it. Eventually, after much damage to the Jewish community, the decree was eliminated, and the status of, as we can still see, well, we don't see it anymore because the French coins don't exist anymore. We have the euro now. But until a few years ago, every French coin had this liberté, égalité, fraternité, which means freedom, equality, brotherhood. And so the status of liberté, égalité, fraternité was reestablished for the Jews, at least until the fateful defeat at Waterloo in Belgium. That was his battle that he really lost big time. Then, at the discretion of each European leader, the fate of the Jews became again one of hardship, restriction, stigmatization, and ghettoization. The last word not really being a word. I just made it up. Ghettoization. As friend and foe, Napoleon still did much for the emancipation of the Jews, and his legacy continued after his death. But victims of reversals of fortune in the post-Napoleonic era, the Jews returned to the scene as the scapegoats of humanity. some of the worst chapters of their history were about to be written. The 1815 Council of Vienna worked very hard at reestablishing the old order as the new anti-Napoleonic nationalism would help to once more take away basic rights for the Jewish people. We're almost back to, you know, not the Middle Ages, but, you know, no rights for the Jews. In 1819, the Germans were again inciting violence against the Jews, and Pope Pius VII reinstated the ghetto, maybe feeling that if we keep them contained, we'll protect them. I'm not sure. Emancipation would continue slowly and sporadically across Western Europe, pulling away Jewish people from religious practices and settling them into a new class of laborers and socialist ideologues. So Jewish people still continue to... I mean, what Napoleon started, even though there's going to be a lot of turmoil, and they're going to go back into being harassed and becoming again, like I said, the scapegoats of humanity, emancipation is not going to stop. This is not something that even if they wanted to reverse it or stop it, they couldn't do it. It was too late. You look at the story of the fiddler on the roof. You got this, the tailor. He's got some crazy new modern ideas. That's the picture of emancipation, Haskalah for the Jewish people. And then you've got Tevye. He's got, he's rooted in Jewish customs, and he doesn't understand how this modern guy, wants this sewing machine, and he wants to move to America and all those things. So that's, you have the two kind of Jewish people here. It's a perfect example. So it continues, but it doesn't continue with the freedom and the peace aspect that they had under Napoleon. While Western Europe was reverting much of the progress of the emancipation, Eastern Europe continued its policy of hatred and harassment. Russia, where at least half of world Jewry lived by then, was never affected really in a big way by emancipation. Firmly rooted in Eastern Orthodoxy or Russian Orthodoxy, and driven by a certain distrust for European progress, back then already, Russia had forbidden the Jews entry into the country. But by a twist of fate, or the hand of God, as I'd rather say, because a twist of fate doesn't work in my book, they ended up partitioning Poland, and Poland became part of Russia, and they ended up with the largest community of Jews in Europe. So now Russia has the most Jews in Eastern Europe. They just don't want them. What are we going to do with them? Something had to happen. That's when this concept of the Pale of Settlement is introduced. And the Pale of Settlement is, if you want to summarize it, what it is, it's a large geographical area or a big geographical ghetto. Instead of being a ghetto with walls within a city, like a district of Venice or district of Warsaw, of Lodz in Poland, and you've got those walls where you have to go in and out at certain hours of the day and night with restrictions. Now you've got a whole geographical area where Jews are just packed in there, do their own thing, and stay there and leave us alone. And that's about 1 million square miles. That's quite large. Next page has a map of the Pale of Settlement. Okay, I've given you that map earlier in a previous lesson, but I re-included it here for free. Jews were allowed to live there. It included much of present-day Lithuania, Belarus, Poland, Moldova, Ukraine, and parts of Western Russia. It was acquired by the Russian Empire during several military conquests. We're missing an S here. Military conquest that took place between 1791 and 1835. The Pale of Settlement lasted until 1917. The order for the confinement of the Jews was made official by Catherine II at the same time when she extended an invitation to all foreigners of all the world to come to Central Russia. She said, "You're all invited to come and settle in Russia and live with us, all but the Jews." She had too many already in her country. She had to do something with them. So they were confined to the Pale of Settlement. The Pale of Settlement, this area basically is, you look at Fiddler on the Roof, the shtetl, which means a hamlet, a small village, that's within the Pale of Settlement. That is life. Of course, it's romanticized, and it's a little bit of a comedy in it, but it's the life, the bittersweet life, the bitter life, really, the bittersweet aspect in a movie, but it's a very bitter, a very hard life in the shtetl, in the little village. This is where my great-grandmother came from. She left the pogrom, she left the shtetl, and I forgot what date, but she left with a couple things on her back and with her family, and she escaped the Russian pogroms that way, like many of them did. Went to Western Europe, France, and different countries, and Germany, and a lot of them went to... Back then, it was known as Palestine, excuse my French, and in America as well. But that's later on. That's for the immigrations of. We'll talk about that during Zionism. That's next week. Even within the Pale itself, Jews suffered many restrictions, additional taxes, and much hardship. Life was really hard. They couldn't do a whole lot. They went through several leaders, some not as harsh as others. Very little relief under Alexander I. Their condition worsened under his successor, Nicholas I. Russia's own answer to their Jewish problem quickly became the Russification, and that is a word, of the Jews, make the Jews into Russians. But what they did is that in 1804, which is the year when Napoleon became emperor, Nicholas I introduced the infamous military conscription, forcing all kids in the military at age of 12 and over to get into the military, basically. This also allowed for the deprogramming of Jewish kids, basically put them in the military, they become Russian soldiers, and if they make it. And it often, very often it happened through kidnapping. They would send what they called snatchers, people that would kidnap Jewish kids in the villages and enlist them in the Russian army and send them the furthest away possible from their family. They would never reconnect with their family, and they would not know any better. They would just end up becoming, you know, indoctrinated with Russian Eastern Orthodox religion, and they would lose all aspect of that. So God knows how many of those Jewish people, don't even know they're Jewish anymore. And there's a lot of people in the world today that might have Jewish heritage that don't know, because they are descendants of all those deprogrammed or reprogrammed Jewish kids that were, you know, sent to the military to take everything Jewish away from them, to get rid of the Jewish people. Yes?
I think it's written here Nicholas the First. I think it's Alexander the First.
Yeah, you're right. Very, very true. Alexander, sorry. 20 lashes? Okay. See? They're going after the Jews again. Okay, so I claim anti-Semitism. Okay, so... the result was far from satisfactory, so Alexander introduced... I'll have to check on that. Maybe I have the date wrong, too, but because I thought it was Nicholas. But the leader of the time introduced an educational reform in 1840, trying to... we'll have to double-check that. Trying to pull Jewish people from traditions and Talmudic studies. Both had little effect. I mean, there were some... little effect doesn't mean like, you know, they got three kids out of the whole, you know, Russia. I mean, it affected quite a few lives, but it was not successful to the level of getting rid of the Jewish people, like Hitler killed 6 million Jews. You're talking about something different here. So it was not that successful. 90% of Russian Jews lived inside the Pale, yet it grew from 1.6 million in 1820 to 5.6 million in 1910. The 1860s brought the Jewish communities of the Pale some privileges, just a few. But this was quickly reversed by the May laws of 1882. Happened in May of 1882, just in case I had to clarify that. They were called the May laws, restricting Jews to overcrowded urban areas, kind of like putting them back into, you know, ghettos within a big ghetto again. Additionally, the pogroms, the riots, that's what pogrom means, of the 1870s through the early 1900s created a very hostile environment that exacerbated the miserable conditions in which the Jews lived. The first pogrom, it looks like it might have been as early as 1821 in Odessa, back then it was in Ukraine, Odessa, Ukraine. The official reason given for the hundreds of pogroms was the assassination of Alexander II in 1880, for which some blamed the Jews. Who else? When all else fails, blame the Jews. Should make a t-shirt like this. I'm sure it would sell real well. When all else fails, blame the Jews. I'm sure it already exists.
And then you could go to the conference.
There you go. There you go. Pogroms became very quickly government-sponsored riots against the Jews. The government, the police, the army, the government would either look the other way or actually organize some of them against the Jews. They claimed the lives of many in the little Jewish shtetls or hamlet of the Pale. The pogroms and other boycotts and hardships led to mass immigration to the United States in 1881 and 1914. Those are also known, we'll talk about them next week when we go over Zionism. Those are also known as the first and the second Aliyah, the first and the second ascent or immigration. Aliyah means ascent. When you go to synagogue, when you go to make an Aliyah, to the podium when the Torah is the bima, you it's known as making an aliyah, making to the bima where the Torah is. It's the same word. You're making an aliyah for a bar mitzvah, for a reading during a service. It's the same. The big immigration and going up to Jerusalem, up to Israel. So it's known as the first and second aliyah. And today, when Jewish people immigrate to Israel, that's what they say: I'm making aliyah. I'm immigrating to Israel and becoming a citizen of Israel. It's the same term. So the pogroms and other boycotts and hardships led to mass immigration. You see the map, those little dots on that map of the pogroms in Russia. Those are the main one. They were happening all over the place. All you know, it's like you would be sleeping in a little village, and all of a sudden a bunch of Russian soldiers or Russian local police or whatever they were. And I'm sure in the mix there was also some peasants that would just join for the fun of it, would come and rape the women, kill the men, and enlist the kids into the army and do whatever else, and you know, steal everything and burn the village down. And those things really happened. And it forced the Eastern European Jews of Poland and Russia and the Pale of Settlement into making a move out of there as much as they could. That was before the Holocaust. That's, we're looking at 1881 and 1914, the two major aliyah or aliyot. It also, you know, as a result of the Enlightenment and the Haskalah, you know, the modernization of Judaism, we have now Jewish people starting to talk about, okay, we can't stay here. We got to do something. We're going to find something. Thus, as we see next week, 1896, a few years down the road, the Dreyfus Affair in Paris, we'll talk about it in detail. And then, as a result, the birth of modern Zionism. Okay, we got to fight for a country of our own, the rebirth of Israel down the road. But that's kind of want to create the whole thing. Of course, the Holocaust, you know, influenced that greatly, you know, but it started at that time when the Jews were going, like, enough already. We have been given freedoms. There's been an emancipation, but we can't use it as long as we're here. We got to do something different. We got to, not all of them were in favor of it. There's always been the protagonist of modern Zionism, and then those who said, no, we have to stick to our old roots, and then we'll talk about that more next week. Eventually, the Pale of Settlement was dismantled in 1917 after the fall of the Russian Empire. At the end here, I quoted an interesting description of the 1903. There were several pogroms in Kishinev, Russia, and this one is the first Kishinev pogrom at the time of the Eastern Orthodox Easter season in 1903. And it was a reporter that wrote in the New York Times back in 1903, the anti-Jewish riots in Kishinev, Bessarabia, modern Moldova, are worse than the censor will permit to publish. There was a well-laid-out plan for the general massacre of Jews on the day following the Orthodox Easter. The mob was led by priests, and the general cry, "Kill the Jews," was taken up all over the city. The Jews were taken wholly unaware and were slaughtered like sheep. The dead number 120 and the injured about 500. That's talking about one location here. This is like, you multiply that by 100, 200, more than that. The scenes of horror attending this massacre are beyond description. Babies were literally torn to pieces by the frenzied and bloodthirsty mob. The local police made no attempt to check the reign of terror. At sunset, the streets were piled with corpses and wounded. Those who could make their escape fled in terror, and the city is now practically deserted of Jews. 1903 pogrom in Russia. One example, as reported by an American reporter in the New York Times. How many went unreported? How many got even worse than that? God only knows. As the last quarter of the 19th century was approaching, Jews were about to experience another major shift in anti-Semitism. Racial anti-Semitism was about to emerge on the scene. We went from ancient theological anti-Judaism, that's how we started with the closing of the canon of the Bible and the church fathers, ancient theological differences, theological anti-Judaism, to modern religious anti-Semitism, to more of an ethnic and cultural anti-Semitism, and now we're going to go into racial anti-Semitism. We're about to enter a next step. Now, what's going to be introduced with the help, as I put here, as I close, with the help of from science, or pseudoscience, really, when you think about it. Now we are about to introduce Jews as a race to be eliminated. You know, and now there's going to be science. You're going to see the Nazis. It's not quite there next week, but you're going to start seeing pictures of Jews measuring their nose and their cranium, and then, you know, as opposed to Aryan, and then this is bad, this is good. Now science is proving beyond the shadow of a doubt that Jews are a subhuman race that must be eliminated. That's where the Nazis are going to do a service to the world by trying to kill the Jews. We're not quite there yet. Next week, we'll talk about the birth of Zionism and the Dreyfus Affair. Thank you.